What's up, pals? You're listening to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast. And wow, you know, I know you probably already listened to this, but I got to play it for those of you who might not have heard it. They somehow recorded the sound of a black hole. And it's spooky. This is what it sounds like. Isn't that creepy? Almost sounds like voices. I want to brag, but I'm a pretty sophisticated audio engineer at this point. I've been doing the podcast for a long time, been to a lot of different audio schools for music and sound. And I realized maybe if I work with a plugin, I could adjust this so I could bring out that voice in there and hear what it is. So I just started changing the frequencies. And you can see right there, right around there, you can hear that? The higher frequencies sound like voices. Listen, right there. Do you hear that? Right there. Now, if I dial it up, weirdly, to frequency 666, not frequency, frequency, I get this. And the more I adjusted it, the weirder it got. Now listen to this. You hear that? That sounded like voices to me. So I dialed in the frequency even harder and harder and harder, and this is what I got.
You may begin your questioning, magistrate.
Thank you, Honor. Will you please state your name?
I'm Archdemon /Snort.
And what is your address?
I live in the Citadel of Eternal Horror, by the molting pits and the larva pool.
And how old are you?
I just celebrated my 500th molting, as did my larva pup, who is now celebrating its 73rd molting.
And what is your profession?
I flay the skin from the unbaptized and puppeteer their skeletons in front of the larva pools for the young demon children.
Now, why are you here?
I was in a shitty relationship with Johnny Depp. I normally don't mate with humans, but I'm a big fan of Pirates of the Caribbean. I think he's a wonderful actor.
At that point, it just goes back to the fucking boring black hole sounds. But holy shit, if I'm correct in my analysis of that audio, it appears that Johnny Depp is on trial all across the universe right now. And that freaks me out. We got a great podcast for you today. Dr. Andrew Weil is here with us. This guy's cool. He opened up about what went down between him and Alpert and Tim Leary at Harvard. The incident that got Richard Alpert, who later went on to become Ram Dass, kicked out of Harvard. Not only that, we had a great talk about psychedelics, the benefits of cocoa leaves, and he may have cured my COVID smell. We're going to jump right into it. But first this. Do you know a long time ago, doctors wouldn't wash their hands? One second, they'd have their fist far inside a corpse's asshole. The next second, they'd be delivering a baby. Using the internet without ExpressVPN is like letting a doctor who just fisted a corpse deliver your baby. You don't want to do that. You don't want to. Look, I go on the road a lot these days, and I'm so happy with ExpressVPN. I just press a button, and then I can watch all the kinky porn I want with the protection of a powerful VPN. I could say I'm in Seattle. I could say I'm in Texas. I could say I'm anywhere else but the hotel room I'm at watching foot fetish porn, because I don't want people to know that I look at that. I want my privacy protected. And that's what ExpressVPN does for me. It creates a secure encrypted tunnel between my device and the internet. It'd take a hacker with a supercomputer over a billion years to get past ExpressVPN's encryption. It works on all your devices, phone, laptop, tablet, even on your smart TV, and it's super easy to use, even for me. I can barely figure out how to use my PlayStation anymore, but I just press a button and it turns on and it works and I love it. And I don't have that creepy, weird feeling I get when I go online at a hotel or wherever without protection. Get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN free at expressvpn.com/Duncan. That's expressvpn.com/Duncan. expressvpn.com/Duncan. And we are back. Okay, I got some shows coming up. I'm very excited. Phoenix, my dear loves in Phoenix, I am coming your way. I'm going to be there next week at Copper Blues Live. That's May 12th through May 14th with my dear Johnny Pemberton. And then I'm not going to be doing shows until June, where you'll find me at Zany's in Rosemont, Illinois. Lots of dates coming up. You can find them all at DuncanTrussell.com. Also, I'd like to invite you to check out the book that our Patreon just wrote, Esoterotica, a collection of short erotic stories with cryptid encounters. It's available at Amazon.com. You can get it for Kindle. You can get it paperback, even hardcover, if you want to go nuts. All of the profits from this book are going to go to various nonprofits. Right now, I think we're trying to figure out a good nonprofit for Ukrainian refugees. Regardless, this book is going to make you come. Check it out. Links for it are going to be at DuncanTrussell.com. Join the Patreon. We're about to collaborate on another book, and you can get in on that by going to patreon.com/DTFH. I think it's safe to say that the psychedelic revolution of the 60s might not have happened had today's guest, Dr. Andrew Weil, not written a series of exposés for the Harvard Press that got Richard Alpert and Tim Leary out of Harvard. Richard Alpert went on to become Ram Dass, one of my teachers. You know what happened with Timothy Leary? And who knows what would have happened if they had remained at Harvard as professors and scholars? I don't know. Dr. Weil completely opened up about his relationship with Ram Dass and how it evolved over the years. And not only that, we talked about the stigmatization of the cocoa leaf, the plant that cocaine is derived from, and how there's actually a lot of benefit to chewing the cocoa leaf, and how crazy it is that that, along with a lot of other plant medicines, are currently illegal in large parts of the world. It's a really good podcast. I hope you enjoy it. If you want to find out more about Dr. Andrew Weil or the River Styx Foundation, you can go to riverstyxfoundation.org. And of course, Dr. Weil has his own website, which you can find at drweil.com. All the links you need to find them will be at DuncanTrussell.com. All right, let's get going, everybody. Welcome to the DTFH, Dr. Andrew Weil. Doctor, welcome to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast. It's so nice to meet you.
Hello. Good to meet you.
How are you doing over there? Where are you right now?
I'm in Tucson, Arizona.
Nice. Nice. It gets pretty hot out there, though, huh?
We've had some nice, cool weather. It's just starting to get hot. It's pretty clear what's coming.
Oh, yeah. Right. Yeah. We just get rain up here in the mountains, which...
Where are you?
Asheville, North Carolina.
Oh, nice place.
Yeah, pretty nice. Pretty nice. Not only am I a tremendous... I just love Ram Dass, and I love psychedelic culture. Uh-huh. And you... I just thought we could start off by chatting a little bit about your time at Harvard, because you were at Harvard at one of the most wild times, maybe in the history of that school, you were there with Tim Leary as a professor, Richard Alpert, a.k.a. Ram Dass, and I don't know if you were aware of this or not, but also the Unabomber.
Yes, I didn't know that till afterward.
Okay, you never crossed paths with him.
Not as far as I know.
It's just, to me, mind-blowing.
But by the way, one other person. I was a student of Richard Evans Schultes, who was the director of the Harvard Botanical Museum, and he was one of the great pioneers of psychedelic plant research, especially in South America. So, you know, he was a major influence on me at that time, too.
Yes, I just can't imagine what it's like to be in the presence of all these people. Every single one of you were and are innovators in your field, and every single one of you really shaped not just psychedelic culture, but, you know, culture itself. I don't know if there's much of a difference. But I have to ask. I was watching an interview, and you talked about having, in 1961, having a powerful mescaline experience that had you listened to it, you would have dropped out of school. But then you didn't talk about what that experience was. I was wondering if we could just start off by you, if you feel comfortable telling us what
sure.
you experienced.
This was it was synthetic mescaline that I got from a chemical company. And, you know, I took a good solid dose of it. I had taken it once before and nothing much happened. And I had not used marijuana. I had really no other experience of drugs except for alcohol. So I really didn't know what to expect. And on that second time that I took it, I guess I had what you'd call a mystical experience. You know, I was saw the white light. I felt that everything was connected. I felt that what was inside my head was what was outside my head was a reflection of what was inside my head. That everything was as it should be. And I also, I think, saw that a lot of what I was doing as a student at Harvard was relatively meaningless. And that's why I said if I'd followed that vision, I don't think I would have stayed in school.
Okay. Wow. Yeah. Now, I because we're so lucky now that we're living in the, I don't know which psychedelic revolution they're calling this, but one of them, and we do have lots of data out there, somewhat of an understanding of a lot of these substances. Back then, they were relatively new, right? You didn't know what this was.
No, very few people had heard of them. I had read Aldous Huxley's book, The Doors of Perception, which was about his mescaline experiences. That made me really curious and want to try it. Nobody I knew really knew anything about it. I had heard that there were these two people at Harvard who were interested in studying it, Alpert and Leary. I went and met them, talked to them. I'll just give you my brief impressions. Leary was very charming. He was like an Irish leprechaun,
yeah.
Very twinkly in his eyes. And he really thought that these were the most interesting things he'd ever come across. And he felt that they were going to completely change society. And he was incredibly enthusiastic about them. He did not foresee any opposition to using them, really wanted to study their positive potential. Alpert was a different story. He was, I think, uncomfortable in himself. I did not feel the same kind of level of comfort talking with him. And I had asked if I could be a subject in their research, and Leary said no, they were sorry because they told the university they couldn't use undergraduates. But he gave me some leads as to where I could get hold of mescaline. And, you know, one of those panned out. I found this chemical company that was willing to sell it.
Back then, did you just, you could just write a letter, or how did you?
I just wrote a letter, said I wanted to study mescaline, and it arrived in my doorstep.
Wow, that is so cool. Because, you know, I lived through the, you too, all of us, anyone around at a certain age lived through what is known as the war on drugs.
Yeah.
The stigmatization of all consciousness-altering substances, the homogenization of them is just one thing called a drug that was bad. So can you just talk about what that was like to take a psychedelic prior to all the conditioning that made us feel like, oh my God, we're taking drugs or we're ruining our minds or we're destroying our lives with this.
Well, let me tell you one story from just a little bit before that. There were a group of people that I knew who were dosed without their knowledge with LSD at a party. This was about 1960. And literally no one had ever heard of LSD. And when they felt the effects of it, they thought they had food poisoning. I mean, really interesting. They had no way to interpret what was happening to them.
Whoa. They didn't. Oh, my God. Right.
So there's a strong, you know, you have to learn to interpret the effects of substances. You know, that's with pot. That's why so many people that trying the first time feel nothing. And you have to learn to get high on it. And with psychedelics, I think there was something similar that in a time when nobody knew anything about them, you had no expectations, you wouldn't know what was happening to you.
So it was, was it less terrifying for them or less unnerving, or some of the stuff that it can appear in a typical bad trip was are you saying some of that is informed more by the culture than the substance itself?
Well, you know, one of the great contributions of Leary and Alpert was their insistence that the effects of substances are due to an interaction of the substance, the pharmacological effect, and what they called set and setting.
Yes.
That is a person's expectations of what's going to happen, and that can be unconscious, and then the effects of the environment in which they take it. And effects of set and setting combined can completely reverse pharmacological action. You can give a stimulant to someone under certain conditions of set and setting, and they'll fall asleep, and the opposite with sedatives. So, wow. You know, there's enormous room for the shaping of these experiences by what you think is going to happen and where you're taking it and the other people who are around and so forth.
How old were you? How old were you at this time?
So I was 1960, I was 18.
Wow. Yeah. You are a hot shot. You're 18 years old at right. Harvard. You are so interested in these substances because of one book. You're going to the offices of people who would later be these like...
No, actually, it goes back further. I'll tell you, this is funny. In the summer before I entered Harvard, so it was the summer after high school, there was an article in the Philadelphia paper where I grew up about a student at a college in California, supposedly who died from taking mescaline, and it said that he had taken it, very unlikely, and it said that he had taken it for inspiration in a creative writing course, and it made the mistake of quoting a line from one of his last papers, and I just remember the line was galaxies of exploding colors, and when I read that, I wanted to take that.
Wow.
So I started asking, what is this, where can I get it? Of course, nobody knew anything.
Doctor, did we have a connection here? Because what got me into LSD was when I was in elementary school and the cops came to do a film strip. That's what they did at the time. And they were showing how all the drugs are bad. And they got to LSD. And I remember them saying, people see dragons. And right. I, as a kid in elementary school, I want to see dragons. What? What is this? You can see dragons?
Exactly.
Incredible.
Exactly.
So yeah, that's, you know, that right. that piqued my interest that later I followed through. Okay, so just so we could just talk about it. You're a writer at Harvard and you had your own group of people that were studying mescaline because they weren't letting undergraduates get high.
We weren't studying it. We were just taking it.
Okay. You know, is there a difference? I don't know. I know you right. mean scientifically okay. probably yeah. a big difference. But so somewhere along the line, you start writing these exposés showing that like this, the line between professor and student, scientist and experiencer was growing blurry. And because of your expose, Alpert, not Leary, gets fired from Harvard. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that? Like what precipitated that? Do you feel bad about it? Because I'm just curious, like now with all this water under the bridge, what are your feelings about that?
I think everything played out the way it was supposed to play out. I was a reporter for the undergraduate newspaper, the Harvard Crimson. I was also a botany major studying with Schultes. I was taking mescaline myself. So I had a split personality. You know, I wore different hats.
Yeah.
But I was one of the only people on the undergraduate newspaper with a science background. So as this controversy started to develop about these two professors who were using these substances, and there was a growing group of students around them, I was asked to cover the stories related to that. And there was a whole series of stories about stormy faculty meetings and so forth. So I was reporting on that. And I got a lot of points for that from the being in the undergraduate newspaper. And yes, it is true that the stories I wrote, that was eventually what led the university to fire Alpert.
Yeah.
That was front page news in the New York Times. So it was a huge coup for the Harvard undergraduate newspaper. But it was also the first time that most people in this country read about psychedelics.
Right.
So that explosion, I mean, that really disseminated knowledge and awareness of all this, I think, for the first time. It took several years for me to realize the implications of all that. I then went to medical school. And in my senior year at Harvard Medical School, I wanted to do human experiments with marijuana. They'd never been done. You know, wow. Once in history, people had given pot to human subjects. Nothing on it. It was becoming like such a huge thing, and no studies. So I tried to devote my senior year research time to doing a human study of pot just to get basic information. That caused, I cannot even begin to tell you how difficult it was to get permission to do that from the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, from the Food and Drug Administration, from the state of Massachusetts, from Harvard University, from Boston University, where I was going to conduct the experiments. Eventually, Harvard gave permission for me to do it. And the only reason they did was because I saw minutes of their meetings that I was the one who had blown the whistle on Alpert and Uri. Wow. So that got me points within the academic community, and I was allowed to do these pot experiments, which showed that pot was a relatively mild substance, and people didn't want to hear that in those days.
Was that post Nixon when you did?
Not yet. That's coming later.
Okay. So then it was stigmatized. Even pre Nixon, it was
true.
Like, okay.
Absolutely. Sorry. But then I began to realize that, you know, I really had to make amends for the whole thing I'd done to Alpert and Uri. I did an internship in San Francisco, and Uri at that time was living in Berkeley. This was 1968, 69. And I called him up, and he invited me over to his home. Very friendly. He had no hard feelings. He said, you know, this was exactly what was supposed to happen. Yeah. We had a really good time. But then I said, you know, I really would like to talk to Alpert. He said he thought that would be more difficult. but he gave me, I think he told me how to reach him. I had to go back to the East Coast. This was now Nixon's first year. And to go from San Francisco in that year to Washington, D.C. was horrible. Mm. And I was serving my military time in the public health service and got a job at the National Institute of Mental Health. They hired me to coordinate marijuana research in the country. But before I got there, they decided I was an undesirable person because the research I had published was not what they wanted out there.
Wow.
And I had done it without their support. And they'd been given, it's a complicated story, but the National Institute of Mental Health was a Democratic pork barrel. And suddenly it found itself under a hostile Republican administration.
Oh, wow.
That was asking them what they had done with their money. And they had been given several $100,000 by Congress years before to study pot. And they hadn't done anything. They hadn't published a single word. And I was the only one who had published research on it, not with their money. And it also said stuff they didn't want to hear. So they tried to get rid of me, and they couldn't, and I was given no job. I had to report to a windowless closet with a telephone in it. And they would tell people I wasn't there when people would call up wanting my opinion on marijuana. They said they didn't know where I was.
Wow.
Opened my mail, really bad stuff. But I thought, okay, I'll stick this out, you know, if it's better than going to Vietnam. But it was during that time I got a number for Alpert. He was in somewhere in New England. I called up, a woman answered the phone, and I said I'd like to talk to him. He got on the phone. I said, this is Andy Weil. And he just went, and so I said, you know, that I'd been doing a lot of thinking and it was really important for me to talk about what happened and why. And there was just silence. And then finally he said that he was flying into Washington, I think a couple weeks later, and that he had to fly out and I could pick him up and take him to the airport.
Wow.
So I went to this hotel in Virginia. I did not know he had been giving a talk, I think, to the American Psychological Association. And I was in my car outside, and out comes this guy with a beard and white robes. Wow. You know, this was his first appearance as Ram Dass.
Yeah.
And I also didn't know the talk he gave that I picked him up from was the basis of his book, Be Here Now, which shortly afterwards I read and had a huge influence on me.
Pretty sure that when at last we're living in a society that hasn't been completely impaired and set back by the idiot war on drugs, that we will realize that the thing we call microdosing now is actually correct dosing. That because of the prohibition, people were just basically ODing on all kinds of substances, including cannabis, which is why I love Lumi Labs, because they are the creators of micro dose gummies. These are the perfect dose of THC. It's incredible. Somehow it's legal everywhere. I don't know why. I'm not going to question it or challenge it because I live in a place that, for whatever dumb reason, has made marijuana illegal. I fly with these things. I just throw these delicious gummies in my backpack. I travel with them. It is amazing. And look, I could go on and on raving about these wonderful gifts from God, but I thought I might share with you the testimonial of my brother-in-law, John, who went through almost an entire jar of these things over the few days that he was staying with us.
I've tried many brands of gummies over the years. I've tried different formulas of CBD, THC, Delta, etc. And I always felt like I was wasting my money. And I was. Hundreds of dollars just on that quest for the perfect, like, edible gummy that isn't too much or too little. Like, we've all been there. We've overdone the dose. I don't like feeling like I've blown my brain matter all the way to the Hyades, and I'm praying for it to end, but I also want to, you know, feel a little background glow. But so one day I tried the Lumi gummies, and once I felt the subtle glow emanating from that gummy in my tummy, I realized I had found kind of what I've been looking for, the Goldilocks zone. The Lumi gummies have zeroed in on what is to me the perfect cocktail of THC, CBD, Delta, whatever is in it. I'm not a chemist. But it's a great daily driver that is reliable.
It goes on for another 5 minutes or so, but you get the point. Lumi Labs microdose gummies are perfect. To learn more about microdosing THC, just do a quick search online or go to microdose.com. and use code Duncan to get free shipping and 30% off your first order. Links can be found at DuncanTrussell.com. That's microdose.com, code Duncan. Thank you so much, my dear friends at Lumi Labs.
So he got in the car. He didn't say much. You know, I said that I had gotten into a position similar to what he'd been in at Harvard, where I was in an institution that was very hostile, and that I was leading this kind of double life, sort of like, you know, looking like a straight doctor, but I was, you know, increasingly using substances and seeing the world in a different way. He mostly just listened. He just listened. Anyway, I shortly afterwards listened to the tape of the talk that he'd given. And as I say, that was very influential. It got me into starting to meditate and doing yoga and being interested in Eastern religion. And I really felt he was a teacher of mine, even though it was, you know, in an odd sort of way. Anyway, over the years, we kept in contact. When he had his stroke, I did a fundraiser for him in Santa Fe. I gave a talk. I guess a few years before he died, a mutual friend was very insistent that we get together and spend time and, you know, clear all this karma up.
Yeah.
So I went to Maui and had dinner with him. I spent a little time with him. And then we had a very intense morning together, just one-on-one. And in the midst of which, he said, you know, you did me a blessing. And he said, you know, that I would not have been Ram Dass if I had not been forced out of Harvard. And in fact, I think if he'd stayed there, it would have killed him spiritually and in lots of other ways. So, it just felt like a closure of something. And I think, you know, we reached some point of common ground there. And I do, you know, I have great respect for him, and he has been a teacher of mine. I've learned, even though not in a formal way, that I've, you know, a lot of inspiration for what I did really came from him.
Thank you for that. Thank you for that. And yeah, I think that I often think, what if you had not written those exposés? Not only would there be a Ram Dass, sometimes I wonder, would there be the psychedelic revolution? What if they had, gone out of the orbit of what a normal academic does, but then just gone back in at some point and then just stayed as like at professors or at writers or serious scientists? What do you think would have happened in an alternate timeline?
Gosh, I think it could have been very different from what we've seen today. But, you know, also, there was such positive interest in psychedelics early on, great stuff with terminal cancer patients, with prisoners. And then, you know, it all got just clamped down. I don't know whether you've seen my, you know, one of my early books called From Chocolate to Morphine.
Oh, yeah. It got banned. Florida. They tried to, did they
right,
ban
exactly.
it? They wanted to
so
burn
that came
your
out
book.
Right as the war on drugs began. It was like just the beginning of that. And, yes, the book, there was attempts to ban the book.
Florida,
yeah. So I was on the other end of that kind of stuff for a long time. And it's wonderful to see what's happening today. You know, it's taken a very long time, but I think this is unstoppable now, this momentum. I cannot believe the mainstreaming of some of this stuff. You know, like a few months ago, Vogue magazine had a cover story on psilocybin. And more recently, Town and Country magazine, of all things, Town and Country magazine, had a feature article called Why Is Everyone Smoking Toad Venom? Town and Country? What the fuck?
What the fuck? Well, this is because
and
of the...
And by the way, yes. Something that annoys me a little bit. I was... And you know who Wade Davis is?
Sure.
So he and I wrote the first scientific paper on toad venom. And nobody ever... We don't get credit for that. It was like...
What?
Is the first... Yeah.
Wait, are you talking about Bufotine?
Bufo alvarius, the Sonoran desert toad in my backyard where I live. And, you know, this was long ago I think it was in the 80s or right around 1990 that I heard about people smoking toad venom. And I was living in a ranch fairly far out from Tucson, and the toads were all over the place. They'd hop in my house at night. You know, they're gigantic. And so I tried milking the venom, and Wade and I smoked it. Amazing. You know, it was like an amazing experience. And we wrote a scientific paper about this. It was the first documented use of a psychedelic from an animal source. You know, that was a really important discovery, and we speculated about whether indigenous people could have used it. I don't know if there's any real evidence for that, but, you know, it's amazing to see what's happened with that.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you.
I'm sorry for the toads. People should be using synthetic 5-methoxy-DMT.
I don't think people understand, like, how they're harvesting the venom from the toads is really horrible. I've seen videos of it.
It doesn't harm the toad, but people are taking the toads and keeping them in captivity, and the habitat is disappearing, and they're becoming very scarce, and it's it's an endangered resource.
I mean, and from the toad's perspective, here you have over millions of years evolved a poison that's supposed to keep things from eating you. And then these monkey descendants realize it gets you high. It's just rotten luck.
I know.
But can you talk a little bit about 5-MeO-DMT? I have smoked synthetic 5-MeO-DMT, and I just wasn't prepared for it. It was...
Yeah,
just...
you know, people describe it as a rocket ship into the void.
Yeah.
Have you ever done a regular DMT?
Love regular DMT.
Okay, so that's, you know, an amazing quick trip into this visual, you know, mostly paradise and interesting stuff.
Yeah.
But 5-methoxy-DMT, it's just you're not there. You dissolve. And when you come back, most people find that rather pleasant. But if, you know, the going out can be scary if you're not prepared for that.
Yes. I'm curious, why do you have any idea why you add an oxygen molecule to DMT and it turns it into this impersonal evaporation?
Well, you know, in South America, there are a number of plant-derived snuffs that indigenous people use. That are psychedelic and that contain both. So usually plants produce both 5-methoxy and regular DMT together. And that combination is probably, pleasant. So it's just odd that this toad produces only one of them. And it's the only toad that has this. And it's probably some random mutation that turned bufotenin, which is a pure poison, into this 5-methoxy-DMT.
Wild. That is what I did not know that you wrote the first paper on that. That is incredible, because it is everywhere now, and a lot of people, use it are using it ritualistically, and it's becoming like woven into.
Yeah, I would never have predicted that. I think it was just amazing to see that.
You, over the course of your lifetime, after all the drama at Harvard and everything, you have been one of the leaders in what's known as integrative medicine. Can you talk a little bit about what the model of like human physiology and healing was prior to the work you have innovated in that field?
Well, you know, I train doctors at the University of Arizona, and the trainings that we give are designed to teach people all the things they should have learned in medical school but are left out, like nutrition, which is completely neglected. And one of the even bigger omissions is about the healing potential of the human organism. You know, I don't think I heard the word healing used in my years at medical school except in the phrase wound healing in my first year histology course. I mean, that should be like the study of medicine should begin with the fact that bodies heal themselves.
Right.
You know, this is like amazing that we have this potential to, know that something's wrong, to heal, to regenerate, to adapt to injury and loss. And, you know, the body has a healing system and has internal mechanisms of healing. And that's what medicine should focus on.
Right.
And also, most diseases end by themselves. And they end by themselves because the body takes care of them. There's an adage in medicine, probably hundreds of years old, that I love, that the business of the doctor is to distract the patient while time heals the disease.
Wow.
And I really believe that. That's the fact. But most doctors and most patients are very pessimistic about their body's abilities to deal with things. And when I'm with a patient, I'm always thinking, why is healing not happening here? What can I do from outside that might facilitate that? So integrative medicine, that's where it starts, on that premise that healing is possible and that you need to understand the nature of it. And then we look at people as whole organisms. You know, it's not just a physical body. We're also mental, emotional beings and spiritual entities. You know, that principle I talked about how set and setting can reverse the pharmacological action of a drug. The mind can do unbelievable things. And that's completely omitted from conventional medicine. You know, we only look at the physical body.
Why? Why is it omitted?
It's part of the materialistic paradigm that dominates Western science. It's that, you know, scientists only believe in that which they can see, touch, measure, remove. If you observe a change in a physical system, the cause has to be physical. You know, non-physical causation of physical events is not allowed for in materialistic philosophy. So that's why we've never been able to take placebo responses seriously or understand how warts fall off by suggestion.
Yeah.
And it's also why we don't take advantage of all of the mind methods of taking advantage of the mind to influence the body. I mean, there are these wonderful therapies like hypnosis and visualization and guided imagery, incredibly effective, cost-effective, and very underutilized because people don't believe in them. They don't think they're, you know, they're real.
God bless you, sweet saints of Squarespace, for supporting this episode of the DTFH and for creating an all-in-one platform for me to put the DTFH online. Check out DuncanTrussell.com and witness the power of Squarespace. They've got everything you need to sell anything, your products, content you create, even your own time. Whether you want a home for your podcast, or a place for you to sell your merch, or just a place for your community to gather, Squarespace has got it all. You want to create a members-only area on your website? You can do that with Squarespace now. You want to send out beautiful emails to your client base? You can do that with Squarespace. You want the best, most cutting-edge stats on how many people are visiting your website and where they're going? You can do that with Squarespace. Even better, they can connect all of your social media outlets into one place easily. Squarespace has it all. If you're thinking about building a website, it's the place to go. Head over to squarespace.com/Duncan. You can try them out for free. And when you're ready to launch, use offer code Duncan, and you're going to get 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. Squarespace, they're incredible. I've been using their service for years, and you should too. Thanks, Squarespace. What's the offhand? What's the most spectacular healing that doesn't fit into that materialist paradigm that you've witnessed?
You know, I've reported a lot of cases in my writings over the years, and some that I've experienced personally, some that I've seen in patients. I'll just tell you one, you know, quick story. I was traveling. This must be in the 1980s. I was traveling from the Pacific Northwest back to Arizona. I stopped off to see my friend Paul Stamets near Olympia, Washington. Oh. And I got into a hot tub that he had, and it looked a little sketchy to me. I mean, I'm very careful about hot tubs. And this,
what do you mean, dirty?
It didn't look like it should have.
Okay,
and
I got
anyway,
you.
When I the next Ugh. Day when I got out, I started getting I thought it was a rash at first, but then it was like pustules on my arm that were sore, and they began spreading. I got them on my legs, and it seemed like they had pus in them, but if I'd squeeze them, nothing came out, and they were painful. And this is hot tub folliculitis, and it's caused by Pseudomonas, which is a nasty bacteria, and it's generally resistant to antibiotics, and I didn't want to take antibiotics, and I couldn't do anything. I was on my way home. So I was soaking them with, you know, hot compresses. By the time I got home, I had some appearing on my face, No, I didn't like this at all. So I was freaked out. And I had a friend, wife of a friend of mine in Washington State, who had become certified in this technique called guided imagery. And my wife then had had a very positive experience with guided imagery. And she said, why don't you call her and maybe she can do a session with you over the phone? And I said, that's ridiculous. This is a bacterial infection. You know, what possibly could that do for it? And she said, well, why don't you try? Because she'd had dramatic experience with it. So I called my friend Marilyn and she said she'd never done a session over the phone, but she was willing to try. So I remember sitting in my living room, I had the phone receiver cradled in my shoulder, and she said, you know, she put me in a relaxed state, and then she said, go to the one of these that's causing you the most discomfort. And it was one on my cheek. And she said, what is it? What do you see there? And I said, well, I see a sort of mass of swirling angry energy. And she says, and what is it trying to tell you? So, you know, I sort of listened and I said, well, it's saying it can't come out, that it can only be absorbed inward. And she said, so what does that mean? I said, well, I'd been trying to force this out. You know, I was soaking it, squeezing it. And she said, so what should you be doing? I said, well, I guess I should be, you know, resting more. And I think taking vitamin C, something else I got. Or I got sort of eating chili peppers. So when I hung up, my wife said she could see a change in the way these looked. I couldn't. But the next morning when I woke up, it receded, and over the next 24 hours it disappeared.
Wow.
I mean, that's I could give you story after story of this kind of thing, but it is so distressing to me that doctors do not use these methods. You know, they never think to use them.
No, is this because I don't think it's necessarily because doctors are sinister. Isn't it more that the entire system,
they didn't learn it. And it doesn't fit in with their preconceptions of how the body works.
Yeah. Okay. The other thing, because I have a friend, my friend Mitch Horowitz writes a lot about the ESP research and how there is data showing that there's clearly some kind of possibility of what we call extrasensory perception, but that data gets left out. Like, it gets actively, not accidentally,
right, actively it doesn't suppressed. Fit with the preconceptions of materialistic science. And also, I think this is one of the ways that psychedelics can change the world, because, you know, I have experienced so clearly when I've been in psychedelic states that everything is conscious. You know, that my consciousness is continuous with the consciousness of animals, of plants, of even things that we say are inanimate. You know, that I just think consciousness is basic. And I know so many people who have had that realization in psychedelic states. And you can't explain that to a materialist who has not had, you know, such an experience. But I think that's where I see the real potential of psychedelics to change everything. You know, the world is in such desperate shape right now.
Yes.
And that's one of the only things I see that has the potential to, you know, change consciousness, which could lead to changes in behavior.
Do you, when you are talking about consciousness as this continuous thing running through everything, do you mean it's sort of a field or something, or
I mean, personally, my belief, and it's just a belief, I can't, you know, it's a belief based on my experience, is that consciousness is primary, and that consciousness organizes matter into more and more elaborate forms.
Yes.
But that's the materialist version of it, is that consciousness is something that is created by the brain, that arises out of electrical and chemical activity in the brain.
Right.
And that when the brain dies, that's the end of consciousness. And it's not what I think.
Right. It's like consciousness is almost, I've read theories of consciousness that it make it seem almost like a mistake, or like, you know, like a like heat coming off an engine or something like
that. So the fancy word for mistake in science is epiphenomenon.
Okay.
That's what the materialists say. Consciousness is an epiphenomenon. It's an incidental thing that just arises out of the chemistry and electrical activity of the brain.
Just something, and why even bother with it? But I get it, because how to quantify consciousness, measure it, how to, you know, have a sample of consciousness that you can look at with a microscope. It's you can't. And so it has to, maybe they just have to ignore it until we get better scopes or something to pick it up. What a shame.
But it's changing, and it's, I think, a major reason why it's changing is because more and more people have had this vision that has come to most people, I think, through psychedelic experience.
Do you feel that social media and like the current, like, I don't know, systems that people are using to interact with are, you know, part of the reason that there's so much confusion in the world right now? And
yeah, I do. I mean, it's got such potential, but I think a lot of it is just toxic out there at the moment, and the effects it's having on people are not great.
So do you recommend, when you are working with people, do you recommend a psychedelic regimen, or do you have any suggestions for, I mean, right now everyone is, I think it's so destigmatized, you're allowed to talk about it now, but what sorts of psychoactive substances do you think are best for healing?
Well, let me first say, you know, in the pre-pandemic days, which is hard to remember now, when I was doing a lot of traveling and speaking, you know, all over the country and in other places, for the past few years, no matter what I was talking about, whether it was healthy aging, anti-inflammatory diet, integrative medicine, I would get questions from the audience about psychedelics.
Sure.
People wanting to know how you can get them, how you can use them, how they can find a psychedelic guide.
Right.
And that has only increased. So I think there's tremendous interest in and desire for people to try these things. In our doctor trainings, our main thing is a 2-year fellowship for physicians. And we have classes of about 80 each. We've graduated like 2,500 physicians in all specialties from that now. And there's tremendous demand from them to learn about psychedelics and their potential in medicine and how to use them in therapy and how to get trained to use them. So clearly this is happening. I think for many, many people, this can be very valuable, but it's important that the experience be structured in the right way.
Right.
You know, if you want to get the best bang for your buck out of them.
Yeah.
And I think, I don't know how this is all going to play out as this, you know, becomes more and more available and more legalized. You know, I think there's a lot of questions there. Are big corporations going to try to get in on it? Are people going to try to patent these things?
Right.
You know, how are they going to be used? I don't know. But I'm sure some people will just use them recreationally, but I think there is a tremendous potential. And also I am a little, a little disappointed that people always focus on emotional, mental illness. And I see huge potential in physical illness.
Wow.
I've seen such dramatic changes, cures, remissions of autoimmune diseases, of chronic pain syndromes, of all sorts of things, you know, that people get a break from their usual way of interpreting what's happening in their body, and they see the possibility that they can live without the discomfort they've been having.
One term that gets thrown around a lot is neurogenesis, the idea that you can rewire your brain via psychedelics. Do you have any theories regarding neurogenesis, or is the reason that chronic pain is just your brain is like finding new pathways? Or,
well, you know, I think one of the most interesting things about pain, there are two aspects of it. There's the primary reception of it from nerves in the body, and then there's the secondary interpretation of it,
right,
which is something happening in the brain. And it is possible to interpret pain in a different way. I mean, actually, that's how opioids work. You know, often if you give somebody not so much of an opioid that they're doped up and they can say what they're feeling, a lot of people say, well, the pain is still there, but it doesn't bother me anymore. So that's an effect in the brain.
Right.
And in hypnosis, I've seen very dramatic cures of pain with hypnosis. And often the suggestion to people is the hurt is going out of the pain.
Whoa.
And that's the same thing. You're working on the brain. And whether, I don't know that this is rewiring, maybe it is, or it's like You know, I think the brain is very plastic. It has incredible capacity to, you know, to change, and you can learn to interpret signals differently.
Can you talk a little bit about your breathing technique? I'm only going to speak for myself, but often I'll say people when I mean me. I'm stressed out, man. I got kids, you know.
Join the club.
There's the World War III seems around the corner. You know, it's just so much is going on, and I'm addictive. So there's a lot. I'm down to weed, man. I can't do benzos. I get addicted to them, so I can't have them around.
Yep.
But I sure would love a method to relax that didn't involve taking some hyper addictive, potentially neurologically destructive substance.
Well, there's a technique, I call it the 478 breath, that I've been teaching for a long time. It's a yoga technique. I learned it from an old osteopath who was one of my mentors. Very simple. It's you know, breathing in through your nose quietly to a count of four, holding your breath for a count of seven, blowing air out through your mouth forcibly for a count of eight, and doing four breath cycles at a time can work up to eight. But you have to do this regularly, and it changes the tone of the involuntary nervous system. It is the, of all the techniques and remedies I've studied in my many years, this is the one I've gotten the most positive feedback about. I mean, incredible what this can do. It slows heart rate, lowers blood pressure, improves digestion. It's by far the most effective anti-anxiety measure I've ever discovered. It makes benzos look pathetically weak by comparison. And it gets better the more you do it. And I teach it to everybody. I mean, you can, if you just Google 478 breath and my name on YouTube, you'll find me teaching you the method. And I've had great fun teaching this to groups of people. I'll tell you a funny story. A few years ago, I was contacted by the NSA out of the blue. And they asked me to meet with some of their top people. And they had read my stuff, and they wanted me to come in to their headquarters in Maryland and give a talk on dealing with stress. This was around the time of Snowden, and they said that people were really stressed. So anyway, I went there. It was quite a trip. And I gave a talk to, I think there were 1,000 people in an auditorium, and then it was closed circuit televised around the world. So I don't know how many people did it. And in the course of this, I had everybody doing that 478 breath, which was really powerful. And I've done this with large groups of people. And as I said, I've gotten great, great feedback on it.
This is one of the most fascinating, on top of the, what was it, the Better Homes and Gardens? What was the one talking about?
Town and Country.
Town and Country. To me, this is one of the other things where, you know, if you cut back a few decades and, like, we're shown visions of this, how, spiritual, new age, psychedelic culture and luminaries weirdly are beginning to have this kind of healing relationship with the very systems that, you know, have done a lot of harm to the psychedelic movement. It's wild, isn't it? I mean, was there a moment where you're like, no way, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to teach these people to relax. I want them all.
I jumped at the chance to do that. That would be great.
Yeah. Cool. Cause
if
you wanted
they want
to
know that. Absolutely.
Also, they probably know everything on you, right? They've been reading your emails for a long time. So you better do what they want, because they got everything on you, man. Everything. They got us. Okay. Now, forgive me for this. This is truly self-interest playing through my podcast. I got COVID, and my smell is messed up. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. It's not often that you get a chance to have a one-on-one with a world-famous doctor. My smell is messed up. My pee, my poop, my BO all smell like oatmeal. Coffee smells like oatmeal. It's crazy.
How long ago did you have COVID?
This was probably, I don't know, 9 months or something like that.
Has it changed any in that time? Has it improved some?
Yes. It went through no smell to all of a sudden, you know, in the middle of like in the evenings, I would start smelling this rancid hell smell.
Yeah.
And then now it's all kind of leveled out to, I guess, where my brain is like, yeah, we don't know what this is, so we're going to make it smell
so like a... Time is on your side. You know, the chances are this will come back. They don't know exactly why this happens, but one theory is that it's due to inflammation in areas of the nerves that mediate smell. So anti-inflammatory things may help, like turmeric, which is a very powerful natural anti-inflammatory agent. And it's easy to get turmeric supplements.
Sure.
Get ones that have black pepper in them as well, because it's to facilitate absorption.
Okay.
But that's something that might help.
Thank you very much. I'm going to try. It's the weirdest thing that ever happened to me.
Yeah.
It's cool though. I mean, I like it because it shows you, you know, it teaches me a lot, like about how the brain works and how, or what, you know, it's a fascinating thing that just my brain is returning a signal for, you know, that's unified across a lot of different things, most of them gross, but it is very weird to pee oatmeal. I gotta tell you
that I have never heard that one. That's fascinating.
It's so weird. It's so cool. I just want it to stop. I want to fix it.
It'll get better. You could also try taking some zinc as a supplement, because that's something I found has helped people who've lost smell as a result, usually of a viral infection.
Thank you. I would love to know about your work with the River Styx Foundation. First of all, I just love that name. But why did? Can you talk a little bit about what it is and why they named it that?
This is a foundation that's whose main purpose is to protect indigenous uses of substances. And they have a project with peyote conservation. It was started, there's a man named Cody Swift who has headed it. His father gave the name, and I think he was very interested in Greek mythology. Why he chose that particular name, I don't know, but it's an arresting name.
Yeah.
And I've been working with him because one of the plants that I have been interested in for a long time is coca leaf. And that is such a persecuted substance. It is so different from cocaine. It has many health benefits, and it's been not only maligned and neglected. So we have a project trying to stimulate research on coca, on seeing if we can get legal supplies of it here. And he's also very interested in other plants that have been maligned, neglected, suppressed. Yeah. So there's a whole list of ones that I'd like to look at. Ephedra is a good one. You know, that's a Chinese herb that has been used for thousands of years as a treatment for asthma and other conditions. And, you know, it is a source of a drug called ephedrine, which can be used as a starting material for
meth.
For meth. But the plant itself is, as with coca, the plant itself is, you know, benign and has beneficial uses. Another one similar to that is khat. You may remember that this is a one from Yemen and Ethiopia that's also a natural stimulant, got very bad press during the Iraq war and because GIs were using it.
I remember hearing about it and wanting to try it, but
yeah.
Is it illegal in the West?
It was made illegal. Yeah.
Whoa. If we could just jump back, because we can't skip over coca leaf. I mean, if you think about this, this plant.
Is the sacred plant of indigenous peoples in the Andes. You know, I've studied it for many, many years in South America and in the Amazon. It's a major healing plant, especially for GI disorders. It stabilizes blood sugar. It may help prevent diabetes.
Wow.
You know, lots of potential, and we can't use it. We can't get it because it has been, you know, blamed for all of our problems with cocaine. You know, the problems come from isolating cocaine from coca leaf. It's not coca. Coca has a lot of other things in it that modify the effects of cocaine. Cocaine is there in very small amounts.
Oh,
and,
huh.
You know, it's an amazing plant that has such a history. And the way that that plant has been suppressed and maligned and persecuted, I think it's everything that's wrong with the way that we've approached these natural substances.
What is the indigenous method of absorbing coca leaf? How do they take it?
They chew dried leaves with a bit of some alkaline substance, which can be roasted seashells or ashes of plants.
Whoa.
That facilitate absorption of the substances in coca. And they hold it in their mouth and swallow the juices. And do this, you know, number of times a day. And it kind of combines the uses of coffee and chewing gum in our culture.
Well, have you tried that? Have you chewed?
Oh, yeah. I've used it many, many times.
What's the effect?
A lot. You get a pleasant numbness in your mouth and then a warm glow in your stomach. It takes away hunger and you get energy from it. But it's not a kind of jangling energy that you get from coffee. It's a more useful kind of energy.
Sure.
It just seems to me so silly that we don't have access to this.
Well, you know who does have access? Coca-Cola. I read that Coca-Cola, right? They have a deal. They get tons of this stuff shipped in, right?
That's the only legal export of coca is to a chemical company in New Jersey that extracts the cocaine, sells that to a pharmaceutical company, and then they make a flavoring extract from the rest of the stuff that they give to Coca-Cola.
So early, when they say that cocaine used to be in Coca-Cola, it's not that. It was coca leaf. The psychoactive substance was in Coca-Cola. So,
right. And then they removed the psychoactive substance, but they kept the coca in, I guess, to conserve the name, because there were, you know, hundreds of coca products on the market in the late 1800s, and now there's only one, Coca-Cola. So I think they put it in mostly to just keep the rights to the name. In Colombia recently, an entrepreneur has been selling a coca beer. I mean, technically illegal, but and also a coca soft drink. And Coca-Cola is suing him for infringement on their trademark.
God, that's
and
crazy.
He's countersuing on behalf of Colombia, saying that the name belongs to Colombia and the indigenous population of Colombia. So it's going to be interesting.
Wow.
And Coca-Cola is doing it illegally. So we'll see what happens.
I hate cocaine, dog. I hate cocaine. I crash. Like, I do cocaine.
It is the perfect illustration of how to go wrong in dealing with what nature produces. You know, to take that one element out of the leaf and then represent that as being, you know, the only thing of interest and disseminating it to the world. And then when you get into a lot of trouble, you blame the leaf for all of that and try to stamp it out.
Right. Wow. That is
amazing story.
Whenever I've heard the stories of the old days, Coca-Cola having cocaine in it, or a more libertine approach to these substances, it's always seemed incredible to me. And I hope that's where we're headed now. Or what are you currently engaged in? What are you working on right now? And how can we tune into that?
Well, I have a website, drweil.com, drweil.com. It has a lot of my health information and medical stuff. There's the website of the Center for Integrative Medicine at the University of Arizona, which is integrativemedicine.arizona.edu. You can see about all of our activities and their programs for the public there. I have written a lot of books, all of which are in print that you get from Amazon.
Yeah. But
so, you know, the River Styx Foundation, you can check on their projects. And, you know, we've started a coca project with them, which I'm very excited about. So I'm
busy.
My hands in a lot of pies.
You're busy. And also, this is you are proof of everything you're teaching, because I have to tell you, you seem like young. Like, you seem, you know, like when we think of aging, I'm sorry if this is something everyone says to you or you hear this a lot, but wow, I remember as I'm researching, getting ready for this, and then I looked at your birthday, and that's when it was like, wow, holy shit, it works.
I'm going to be 80 on June 8th. I can't believe it. How did that happen?
Yeah, but you're not. You know, you're not 80. Right. Like, our understanding of 80 is, I guess, a person who has not taken time to do the breathing and to eat the right stuff. That's just a sick person who happens to be 80. But do you have last thoughts? Do you have any predictions as far as aging technology, and can you let people know what your skincare regimen is? Sorry, what is it?
I have a book called Healthy Aging that I recommend, you know, you look at. I'm not very interested in life extension. I think that's a waste of time. I think what we should be concerned with is how to stay healthy as you age. And be able to enjoy life and delay the onset, reduce the risk of age-related diseases. And I think you do that by, you know, doing all the things under your control that we know that influence, you know, general health, starting with, you know, eating right. And the first step of that is avoiding refined processed and manufactured foods, getting regular physical activity, good rest and sleep, doing that breathing technique, which is, you know, really effective way of neutralizing stress. Laughing, having fun. I tell people not to listen to the news. I've long ago was recommending what I called news fasts. And I think that's even more important today because the news is just dreadful and it's a major source of anxiety.
Yes.
And I have to say that, you know, I think my uses of substances over the years has strongly contributed to my physical health and emotional health.
You are an amazing human. I am just so lucky I got to spend time with you. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
And Duncan, I hope you get to see dragons.
Oh, don't worry. I know how now.
All right.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Good.
Much thanks to Dr. Weil for coming on the show. A big thank you to our sponsors. We'll be back next week with a live DTFH with the genius Dan Harmon. Thank you for listening. Hope you have a great weekend. Hare Krishna.